Support for WGTD's morning show comes from the generosity of the family and friends of the late Frank and Beverly Falduto, two lifelong Kenoshans who devoted much of their lives to the community in general and to WGTD in particular. Mr. Falduto played an essential role in creating WGTD nearly 40 years ago and later served as station manager and occasional morning show co-host. And we welcome you to the Tuesday morning show. I'm Gregory Berg. We're spending this portion of WGTD's morning show talking about one of the most brilliant and also controversial innovators in recent history. Elon Musk is responsible for some of the most striking and remarkable innovations in several different industries. He has helped us explore space in ways we never did before. He has helped us develop electrical cars. And he has helped us rethink how we can use the internet. And it is difficult to think about a single person who has had quite so much effect on so many different facets of modern life. And yet by no means is he done. And in fact, in some ways, the most remarkable innovations of Elon Musk have not yet penetrated into the lives of ordinary citizens the way other sorts of innovations have. But in some respects, that day may be just around the corner. At any rate, he is a remarkable man with a really unprecedented career. And that career is explored in a really interesting new New York Times bestseller just out in paperback called Elon Musk, Tesla, SpaceX, and the Quest for a Fantastic Future. The book is written by Ashley Vance, who is a well-known author, and perhaps you know him as the host of Hello World, a technology travel television show. He writes extensively for Bloomberg Businessweek, and as a matter of fact, it was an assignment for them that first allowed him to cross paths with Mr. Musk, and that ended up being the germ for this very, very interesting book published by Echo, an imprint of HarperCollins, again called Elon Musk, Tesla, SpaceX, and the Quest for a Fantastic Future. Ashley Vance, we welcome you to the morning show.
Thanks so much for having me.
Tell our listeners about that article that you wrote for Bloomberg Businessweek and the opportunity that it afforded you to pay your first visit to what you refer to as Muskland.
Sure. Yeah, well, it dates back to 2012. You know, I live in Silicon Valley and was not really an Elon Musk believer. I cover a lot of technology companies here, but he had seemed like this guy who was always promising things but struggling to deliver on them. And then in 2012, some remarkable things happened. Tesla Motors, his electric car company, came out with this Model S sedan that became a huge hit. SpaceX, his space company, got to the International Space Station. And SolarCity, his solar company, filed for a public offering. And so I kind of dug in and decided to do a big story on him. And I found this guy was much more interesting and authentic and just had this fascinating life story that I hadn't expected. And that's really what set me off down this path.
You don't go into really lengthy detail about this, but you do say something to the effect that as you set about writing this book, you hoped for and did not at least immediately receive the kind of full cooperation from Mr. Musk that you had perhaps hoped. And yet he has not been an impediment in this project, and indeed has become, it would seem, progressively more helpful, more open to you. Give us a sense of kind of the relationship that has developed between you, and in particular, what appears to be his deepening sense of trust in you with this project.
Yeah, well, it was a bit of a battle when I first did that cover story for Businessweek about him. We had a fairly good rapport after that, and I floated the idea of doing a book, and you know, initially he said no, he wasn't going to cooperate with me, but he wasn't really going to get in my way. And so I spent about 18 months interviewing 200 people all who had worked at SpaceX and Tesla, and he also co-founded PayPal, so he's got this long history. And I sort of wore him down over time. Those 18 months passed, and he gave me a call and said he wanted to talk about maybe doing the book, but then he came with some pretty onerous terms. He's a very controlling figure. He worries about his image, and he wanted to be able to read the book before it came out and maybe put footnotes in it. And just as a journalist, I couldn't agree to do that. And so we had this big blowout meeting, and ultimately he agreed to do the book and just give me some interviews over the course of about 8 months. And I interviewed another 100 people. And then, yeah, he really opened up. We would have these long dinners, usually 3-4 hours once a month. And it was really the first time that I think anyone got to know the real man and to explore a lot of the ideas in depth that he's talked about. And then since then, things have been a little more tense. There were some things in the book that he didn't care for. And so we've had a bit of a battle in the months that have passed.
Hmm. So, well, when we read about the kind of person he is and the way in which he has led his various companies, I suppose that tumultuousness should not come as much of a surprise. He has, of course, a very intriguing childhood. He was born and raised in South Africa, and it was a childhood that included a divorce and ultimately his decision to go live with his father. And you also describe how in some respects he was a bit of an outsider in his own land. How does he, that is Mr. Musk, view his own childhood? And how accurately do you think he views it in terms of the ways in which it shaped who he is and what he has accomplished?
Well, it's one of the more emotional topics for him. As you mentioned, his parents divorced. He went to live with his father. He had a very difficult relationship with his dad and his mother. His dad was quite hard on him. As a kid, it's really funny. I went back and I interviewed tons of schoolmates that he had over the years, and they all said he was kind of the least likely person that they would have expected to do all this stuff. He was a loner. He was a little bit weird. It's a very masculine, sports-heavy culture, and he was the kid who liked to sit in the corner and read books. He read 1 to 2 books every day and devoured science fiction in particular. And so he was either being left alone or he was being bullied. And he had a couple incidents that were quite bad. He got kicked down a flight of stairs one time and had to go to the hospital for about a week after that incident. And, I think he reflects on his childhood, from what I can tell, pretty accurately. These incidents had a huge impact on him, and I think, just playing sort of armchair psychologist for a little bit, he's part of this quest that he has been on that I talk about in the book, has been to prove to everybody that they were wrong, that he was this very special kid and that he had big things to accomplish. And so it's been a huge chip on his shoulder throughout his whole life.
Right. Some words that leapt off the page when you described what a compulsive reader he was and how he especially would read himself to sleep with 2 different sets of encyclopedias. That happens to be something I did in my own childhood. But of course, that in and of itself doesn't mean you're destined for the kind of greatness that he has achieved. He ultimately moves to Canada in kind of an impulsive move, and ultimately crosses the border to the United States to go to college, which had been a long-held dream. One of the things that you say about him that's, I think, quite intriguing is the way in which he really goes out of his way to insist that many of his most important ideas involving space travel or solar power and some of the other innovations he has developed, he insists that he already had these ideas while he was a young college student. And you have kind of an interesting analysis of why he insists on that particular narrative. Tell our listeners what I'm talking about.
Yeah, it's an interesting point that you picked up on. I always found it fascinating that he would talk at such length about how he had architected this vision for his life from such a young age. And I think he doesn't want to be seen as the typical Silicon Valley guy, definitely not a venture capitalist who's just looking for the next opportunity to dump money into and make a ton of cash. He's tried to portray this picture of him that he's not some money-hungry individual, that he's actually been thinking about these bigger things for mankind all along. People should know that his major quest in life is to set up a colony on Mars because he fears that the human species may be wiped out by some strange event here on Earth, and so he wants to create a backup plan for people. When you look at Tesla and Solar City, they're obvious attempts to try and curb global warming, and so he comes wrapped with these grand missions that he's been chasing after. And so, yeah, he did not want to be seen as just your regular Silicon Valley story of some guy trying to get rich quick, that he's actually got this very purposeful life. And then, part of it, I think, is him. It is true. All of this is true. And I do not think that he's driven by money in the same way that a lot of the people here are. But you also see him consciously shaping his image from a pretty early day.
Right. And of course, by suggesting that he had many of these early ideas when hardly anybody else was thinking about these ideas, gives those ideas, in a sense, even another layer of grandeur by making them ideas far before their time, in a sense. He's not just the typical guy who comes along and builds on someone else's great idea and makes it even better. He really wants us to think of many of these ideas as ideas that he came up with a long, 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 long time ago.
Absolutely. And there's some pretty funny stuff to back this up. He's in Canada, where he first started out at university, and he always struggled to get dates because he was a bit of a loner nerd, to be frank. And there's one where his mom sets him up on a date with this very pretty girl, and she comes over for his birthday party. I think it was his 18th birthday party, and they sit down on the couch, and he basically immediately says hello. She says hello back, and then he says, "Have you ever thought about electric cars?" and I interviewed her about this, and she just thought it was the most peculiar thing that had ever come out of some suitor's mouth before. And so, this is still how he kind of is today.
Mm-hmm. So when you describe the first of his many startups, which is something with his own brother, a company called Zip2, you describe some of the troubles that he has in terms of leading other people. And, of course, this is one thing that has been a hallmark of his career, is the fact that he is not an easy person to work with, and he tends to have rather volatile relationships with everybody with whom he works. And he, in explaining this, mentions the fact that, until this time, he had never been so much as the co-captain of a sports team or in school or anything. He'd never had to lead anybody before. So he has had to try to learn from his own mistakes, and to some extent he has, and to some extent it sounds like he has not, that he continues to struggle with this particular facet of his professional life.
Yeah, well, in his early days, so there's Zip2, and then his next company is PayPal, and you see this guy who's trying to emerge from that youth of always being off on his own and not really having many social skills. And so he comes into these companies, and he's just brutally honest with people in meetings. Some engineer would present something, he'd just say, "You're wrong," but not only that, he would dig into the guy and be like, "Why are you so stupid? Why would you present this in front of us?" And leave the guy in tears in front of all of his peers.
And by the way, I remember you mentioning that one of the things that would really set him off is if he would ask somebody in such a meeting, well, why are we doing that? He said, "Well, that's what we've always done." And those words would just be like the worst possible answer one could give to such a question. I mean, that's
absolutely
the worst reason to do something, is that's the reason we've always done it, and that someone might get fired for saying those words.
Yeah, quite often. And in these first couple of companies, things go okay for a while, and then ultimately he gets either pushed to the side as CEO or thrown out of the company, and so it ends really badly for him. Over time, he's gotten a lot better. I mean, certainly you see him up on stage now addressing thousands of people, and he's much more confident than he used to be, and he's evolved, but But Tesla and SpaceX are notorious today in Silicon Valley for being these incredibly hard-charging places where he still will lay into employees when needed. But, you know, to his credit, one of the best things about him and the reason that he's a success is that he's able to marshal these thousands of engineers to get behind him and to chase after these projects. And so he's clearly developed a way to tame some of these more fearful sides of him enough to push people on.
Right. Of course, what really makes him extraordinary is the way in which he has sought to reshape entire industries in a way that not many human beings have managed to accomplish. For instance, when it comes to, in a sense, reshaping the space industry, a business which he felt, in your words, had not really evolved in about 50 years. One of the ways in which you help us understand his ideas is by talking about Ferraris and Honda Accords, of all things. Explain how this, in a sense, symbolizes his radical new ideas about how the space industry should function.
Yeah, you know, a lot of people don't follow this stuff closely, but basically what had happened is you had the space industry starts to get developed during the 60s and really doesn't change much at all. The rockets are all made by nations, the United States, Russia, China, and they're all designed to minimize failure. And so they're building the Ferraris of rockets, things that cost hundreds of millions of dollars. They're guaranteed not to blow up. And he came in with a sort of different idea, which was, I want to become the Southwest of space. That was SpaceX's motto in its early days when it started around 2002. He wanted to create much cheaper rockets that could go to space much more often. He had a theory that there was a lot of waste in the industry, that things like electronics and software had improved dramatically over the decades, and that this industry needed a reboot. A lot of people had sort of similar ideas. Billionaires had tried to get into space and failed pretty spectacularly. And Elon is the first guy who's managed to pull off private space. And really, for people who don't follow this, the United States had lost all competitiveness in this field as far as being able to launch rockets for other countries to put satellites into space, and had gotten way too expensive. And today, SpaceX is the low-cost way to get something into space, and he's brought thousands of jobs back to the United States. It's, for me, the most inspirational story around him. And you know, if you're into this sort of thing, it's a very patriotic story.
Absolutely. And, of course, what he has accomplished with Tesla is quite extraordinary as well, despite some really, really difficult early days with you describe at one point as a spending horror show from which he eventually emerges. As I indicated in the introduction, we are talking about a great innovator who nevertheless has not penetrated the everyday lives of normal Americans the way some other people have. At one point you write, Musk has yet to have a consumer hit on the order of the iPhone, or to talk to a billion people on Facebook. For the most part, he is still making rich people's toys. How far are we from Elon Musk turning the corner and going beyond that?
We're getting a little closer now. Something like SpaceX is probably never going to enter the consumer consciousness, although we see it on television a lot more now when they have a successful launch, and it has started this whole new space movement to get some attention. For Tesla, they have been producing these cars that tend to cost about $100,000 each. And here where I live in Silicon Valley, they're all over the place, but certainly not a mainstream vehicle. It's this year when finally, after about 15 years, that Tesla may have its moment. The company hopes to come out with a $35,000 car called the Model 3. And it's this vehicle that will either make or break the company and probably a lot of Elon's legacy if he can produce this car on time and keep the company alive. It's still always in a huge cash crunch. Then then this really is his iPhone moment, because Tesla has this huge shining brand, and this car would be the most advanced car on the road. And yeah, I mean, this is kind of what we've all been waiting for.
Right. Last quick question. You say at one point that Elon Musk is more of a Thomas Edison than a Howard Hughes. Explain why we should think of him in those terms.
Yeah, he's certainly done a bunch of industries like Howard Hughes has, but to me, it goes back to the point we talked about before. You know, the most remarkable thing about him is that he has taken thousands and thousands of the world's smartest people, in much the same way Edison had these invention factories, and pulled the most out of them and invented a string of incredible technologies that are behind these companies. And so, you know, this is the best thing about him, is that he's able to give people a sense of mission, to give them the tools they need to go off and invent these things. And so this is why I put him in that category.
Mm. The book, again, is by Ashley Vance's Elon Musk, Tesla, SpaceX, and the Quest for a Fantastic Future, published by Echo, an imprint of HarperCollins, now available in paperback. Ashley Vance, congratulations on a really interesting book, and thank you for joining me today on The Morning Show to talk about it.
Thanks so much, and thanks for the time. Appreciate it.
And it's 8:31. You're listening to the Tuesday Morning Show on WGTD. I'm Gregory Berg. And in the closing portion of today's program, you're going to hear from author James Tobin. This is an interview I conducted some years ago about his wonderful book called To Conquer the Air, The Wright Brothers and the Great Race for Flight, in which James Tobin explores not only the Wright brothers' struggles to achieve human flight, but also the equally frantic and relentless efforts of many of their competitors. I asked Mr. Tobin to explain what kind of resources he turned to in writing his fascinating book.
Well, I guess there are a couple main types of sources. One is archival sources, manuscript sources, the original letters and papers and diaries of the principal actors in the book. And then I use a good deal of media accounts, too, and those are less trustworthy always. On the other hand, some of the newspaper accounts of various events in this whole story give our only view of certain things that were going on, and good detail and good description of individuals. So I use that quite a bit, too. The Wright brothers' papers are split between the Library of Congress in Washington and Wright State University in Dayton, their hometown. And so I was at both places quite a bit and doing a lot of photocopying and bringing those back to my office in Michigan. And then Samuel Langley, the secretary of the Smithsonian, who is a key figure in all this, his papers are at a couple different places at the Smithsonian. And then Alexander Graham Bell, who's also an important character in the book, his papers are at the Library of Congress. So there really is an enormous wealth of material to draw from.
Give us some sense of how long a history we are talking about. I mean, the chapter that of these efforts, which involve specifically Langley and the Wright brothers and some of their contemporaries, is relatively recent in the story. But of course, human beings had at least dreamt about the possibility of flight long before that, and it had achieved flight in some ways, but yeah, not in the dramatic way, which of course the Wright brothers achieved in 1903. Sketch just briefly, if you would, the history ahead of the emergence of the Wright brothers and Langley.
Well, various people down through the centuries had tried various things, most of them sort of variations on glider devices, parachute devices, none of them terribly successful. A Brit named Cayley actually in the early 19th century was the first to conceive of what we would think of as an airplane, the lifting surfaces, steering surfaces. He didn't actually build a working airplane, but he did make designs along those lines, and he did make a glider. And then so through the 19th century, especially in the 1890s, led by the German Otto Lilienthal, a number of people did successful experiments with gliders. This is at the same time, of course, that various Europeans and Americans, and Asians too, were using balloons, lighter than air flight, to get off the ground. So there are all these different conceptions of what it means to fly. And the Wright brothers sort of followed the glider path, but with the idea of imitating bird flight. That is, not being aloft in a balloon where you're at the will of the wind, not sort of going in a controlled fall as a glider does, but figuring out a way to propel yourself through the air and to be able to balance and steer even in a wind so that you're actually flying as a bird flies.
Well, and in control of what is going on, not being completely helpless in the face of what Mother Nature, and especially the wind that Mother Nature might
provide. Yeah, that's right. You know, there are reports that we've been seeing more and more of them in the last couple of weeks as the media starts to cover the centennial. There are various claims by people who say that they flew before the Wright brothers. Well, some people did get off the ground in airplane-like machines. A Frenchman named Clement Audet in the early 1890s, for sure, we know did. There were eyewitnesses to that. But these are machines that are getting off the ground in the same way that a kid throws a rock. I mean, they're propelled upward with momentum, and they keep going, and then they come down. But they're terribly dangerous, and as you say, there's no way to steer them, no way to control them, and they don't really go where they're intended to go, and they're totally at the whim of the wind. That was one of the main factors, was to defeat the problem of gusts of wind coming at you from all angles.
Right.
Very dangerous.
One of the things that I really learned in reading your book was that sense that that these distinctions that we're talking about would presumably be lost on all but a very, very few people. If all you're looking at is a photograph and it's of a good-sized glider up in the air, I mean, that looks like flying as much as the Wright brothers' flight. You say, not to jump ahead, but at that point in the book when finally they have achieved their historic first flights 100 years ago today, you say that the magnitude of what they had done could be appreciated only by those who fully understood the steps they had taken and the problems they had solved through 4 years of work. That included the two of them and no one else in the world. They had flown, barely, but they were utterly alone in their comprehension of what that really meant.
Yeah, it's a striking fact. You know, we all look at this famous photograph of the Wright brothers flying on December 17th, 1903, and we assume, because we know what it led to, that everybody at that time understood the significance of that event. And yet, as I say in that passage, you had to get the whole thing in order to understand how important that the flights of that day really were. And it was actually 5 or 6 years before the Wrights were really able to convince the whole world that what they had done was the true invention of the airplane.
And significantly different from these other efforts.
Yeah, that's right.
James Tobin is joining us. He's author of To Conquer the Air, The Wright Brothers, and The Great Race for Flight. An interesting point is made early on, actually, when you quote a letter from young Wilbur Wright. I think at this point, this is in the prologue of the book, this is a letter I think he had written to the Smithsonian Institution, asking for them to, I think, send him background information on other efforts that had been made towards the goal of achieving human flight. And Wilbur Wright at one point in his letter says, "Birds are the most perfectly trained gymnasts in the world and are specially well-fitted for their work, and it may be that man will never equal them. But no one who has watched a bird chasing an insect or another bird can doubt that feats are performed which require 3 or 4 times the effort required in ordinary flight." So birds were the inspiration for Wright and for others. But at some other point in the book, maybe Wilbur Wright or someone else points out that the flight of birds was not an easy thing, a simple thing to study in order to imitate it.
Right. If you're out in your front yard and you see sparrows and cardinals and blue jays go by, Of course, again, common everyday things we just take for granted. They're moving very fast. It's hard to tell what their wings are doing. If you're looking at soaring birds, the hawks and vultures, seagulls, they tend to be very far away, so it's hard to see what they're up to. And the movements of their wings are often extremely subtle. Experimenters knew that there was something going on in the movement of birds' wings that was highly significant, but they couldn't figure out what it was. It was very tricky business of observation. In fact, I mean, I think until more sophisticated techniques of stop-action photography came about, scientists for many years still had trouble figuring out exactly what birds were doing with their wings and with their feathers.
I love the Ralph Waldo Emerson quote, which you include, that in all nature, birds were the reality most like to dreams.
There is a kind of spiritual aspect, I think, to mankind's pursuit of flight. There's been interesting work done on flight imagery in 19th century poetry and even in 20th century literature, where poets and novelists are writing about airplanes, about powered aircraft. There is a sense in which the bird or the airplane is ascending closer to heaven, is trying to commune with God. And I think it's not entirely insignificant that the airplane was invented by sons of a devout Protestant minister. They themselves had seemed pretty clearly to have given up their father's faith, and yet that sense of spiritual aspiration, I think, is a kind of undertone in this whole story.
As you tell us the story of Langley, I can't remember his first name off the
top. Samuel
Langley, who is the great American competitor to the Wright brothers, in a sense.
Right.
We learn along the way, in his own fascination with this possibility of human flight, that for a serious scientist, a serious-minded scientist, to pursue this meant risking ridicule, because this was at a point in time in the 1880s when, as he said himself, Langley, the whole subject of mechanical flight was generally considered to be a field fitted rather for the pursuits of the charlatan than for those of the man of science. So in addition to risking resources, one was risking one's own reputation,
right,
if you seriously pursued this.
Right, along with life and limb. You know, this was also just physically dangerous to anybody who was going to try it, and that was always at least in the backs of people's minds. But you're right. The consensus in the scientific community, going all the way back to Isaac Newton, who had written about this, was that flight was physically impossible. Human flight, that is, that human beings would never be able to achieve the kind of power and power to weight ratio that would be necessary to fly. And so anybody who tried this was like the same way we would think of somebody trying to build a perpetual motion machine or trying to build a time traveling machine. It struck most people as utterly crazy.
Langley, of course, faced all kinds of challenges, one of them being, in his own words, that in designing this first aerodrome, which was the main vehicle with which he achieved some success, there was no precedent or example. Everything was unknown. This was, he called it uncharted territory, although surely there was something he was building on.
Well, it's a good question, and in fact, there were some precedents that he might have investigated a little more closely, but he did feel he was starting utterly from scratch. I think that was partly his own ego. Langley is a complex character, and admirable in many ways, not so much in other ways. But one of the things that I do admire about him is his courage in just setting out into this utterly unknown wilderness of what to do, of how to build. And so he was sort of grabbing models out of nature from all over the place. He designed what we would call a fuselage to look like a herring, because he was thinking about how what are the objects that travel through fluid? Well, he was thinking of fish. Would that be an effective model for something to go through the air? Of course, he's imitating birds to some extent, but also looking at how insects fly. He was really all over the place in just searching out any possibilities that might help him.
And at one point you say, every failure, however frustrating, was welcome, for it identified another problem he might solve if he tried hard enough and often enough. That's an admirable and fairly rare attitude, maybe not such a rare attitude among scientists.
Well, that's an interesting point. I think most of us don't realize how much that characterizes the scientific process. Science is a hard, hard business that takes a great deal of persistence, and any working scientist will tell you that there are, you know, 97 failures for every 3 successes, and Langley worked that way, and I think many other scientists do too. They recognize that when they come up against something that doesn't work the way they thought it was going to, that presents a new intellectual piece of the puzzle to solve, and if they can solve it, they'll move on to the next problem, and gradually they will make progress in that way. I mean, this is true of the Wright brothers too. They were on quite different paths theoretically. One turned out to be wrong-headed, and one turned out to be brilliantly right. But they really did work in much the same way.
Hmm. One fascinating point you make about Mr. Langley's efforts as he sought to perfect the aerodrome is the way in which his efforts eventually intersected with the U.S. military and the Spanish-American War. Tell us briefly about that.
Yeah, Langley had some very lucky timing. He had built a series of unmanned, what we would call model airplanes, the last of which were very large, so say 12, 15 feet long, which flew successfully without a person aboard under steam power. His idea was to scale that up, to build a larger version, large enough to carry a man, but he was having trouble getting funding for it. And just then, it was the spring of 1898, the U.S. was moving toward war with Spain over the problems in Cuba. And so the U.S. War Department was very much on the lookout for new weapons, and especially new methods of reconnaissance. And this is what Langley presented to them, was the idea that if he could build a successful flying machine for the War Department, they would have this sort of unbeatable means of scouting the enemy. That was how the military airplane was originally conceived, was as a means of reconnaissance. Hmm. So they gave him his money, and he was off and running.
Langley achieves his first flight with one of his unmanned aerodromes, which was a glider, I think without an engine, correct? Or did it have some kind of...
No, the major successes that he had in 1896 were with an unmanned but steam-powered aerodrome. These are the two crafts that are launched from a houseboat on the Potomac River south of Washington.
We should mention that Alexander Graham Bell was on hand and actually took photographs of that historic flight.
Right.
At a glance, it seems like it would not be an insurmountable problem then to somehow get a person in that very vehicle and just do it again.
Yes, that's correct.
But that didn't happen.
No. And part of the advantage that Langley had on those days when he successfully flew that unmanned aerodrome was that he had waited for completely windless days. Again, it gets back to this question of control. That aircraft was able to fly in a calm, and conceivably an identical aircraft, much larger, could have flown a man. But the problem was, as Wilbur Wright said so presciently, the wind usually blows. If you were going to build an airplane that couldn't handle a wind, you didn't have an airplane at all. And so Langley pursued the problem of building a kind of a perfect internal combustion engine, an engine that was very powerful yet very lightweight, that would propel a much larger aerodrome to carry the weight of the engine and the pilot and the aircraft itself. And he recognized that there would be a problem of balance and steering, but he kept postponing dealing with that until he felt he had the engine all taken care of. And then he was ready to make his first flights, again, waiting for windless conditions so that he might make a simple straight-line flight. Even that, as it turned out, was not possible.
Hmm. What was it about the Wright brothers' approach to this that was different from Langley, which led them down an ultimately successful path. In what way were they attacking this challenge technically in a different way?
Well, I suppose one of the most important things is that they were trying to improve upon an existing technology. Now, it's very much the case that the Wright brothers invented the airplane in a truer sense than Edison invented the light bulb or Bell invented the telephone. They really did develop what we know as the airplane. But they looked very carefully at the success that this German Otto Lilienthal had had with gliders. But Lilienthal ultimately died in a crash of his glider because he couldn't control his steering, couldn't control the stability of the aircraft. So they sort of took that and said, well, Lilienthal has made glides of hundreds of yards. What could we do to improve upon his performance and improve upon his machine? And so their whole focus became balance and stability. They realized that if you could build a glider that was perfectly stable in the air and then attached an engine to that glider, you would have, in effect, a working powered airplane.
I like how you quote Will Wright at one point saying, it was going to be an athletic endeavor and its principal goal would be proper balance, as in skating or bicycling or gymnastics. Maybe the fact that Wilbur Wright had been a very good athlete at one point had something to do with him thinking in those terms.
Absolutely. And in fact, he had been good at all three of those very sports. That's another aspect of the Wright's approach that's very different from Langley's. They had a very hands-on, pragmatic, let's give it a try and see what happens approach to their glider work. Langley, you know, at the time that his assistant tried to fly the aerodrome in 1903 for the first time, neither he nor Langley had ever been up in any kind of a glider, in any kind of a flying machine at all. The Wrights had the hands-on feel of how these things flew. When people have tried to build replicas of the 1903 powered flyer and have been unable to fly it, I think a lot of the reason for their failure has to do with the fact that they hadn't put in hundreds of glides in similar machines as the Wright brothers had.
They eventually choose Kitty Hawk, North Carolina as the site for their first really serious experiments. It's interesting that you say that as they sort of scouted the region for promising places to do this. They heard from someone at Kitty Hawk, North Carolina, saying they were promised steady winds and a wide beach.
Yeah.
Two things that are really important for this.
Yeah. They had done research. They Wilbur knew that he needed, for glider experiments, a good steady wind, and so they had written to the Weather Bureau and gotten data back about average wind speeds at various weather stations around the country. And so they got back this good information about Kitty Hawk and decided to try it there. And I think that the sand dunes were sort of a surprise to them. They didn't realize how important that would be to their work. The soft sand, unbroken stretches of sand, that allowed them to make landings in relative safety. There weren't obstructions to get in the way, either of themselves or of the wind. So it was really a perfect place to try glider experiments and ultimately the powered experiments. Kitty Hawk is still, in that area, is still the sort of one of the hang glider and kite flying capitals of America. The conditions are exactly the same as what the Wrights needed.
Wilbur is the older of the two brothers. At some point, you mentioned in 1899 or 1900, the letters that Wright, that's Wilbur Wright, is composing about these flight experiments and efforts. The pronouns shift from I to we, and it becomes very much a joint venture between Wilbur and Orville.
Right. Wilbur, I think all the way through, was sort of the driving personality and the visionary. But it is true that after launching this project, really as a hobby more than anything else, and going to Kitty Hawk the first summer in 1900, and Orville sort of tagging along for the fun of it, that's when Orville sort of catches this aeronautics bug too. And they become more full partners. But it takes a little while. I mean, Wilbur, I think, had been studying it more seriously for several years before Orville really got on board.
The experiments at Kitty Hawk are promising in some ways, discouraging in others. And you talk about how after maybe the first or second summer, they head back home despondent, Wilbur Wright saying, someday people would fly, but the two of them would not live to see it.
Right.
So they really did not know that
just around the bend was going to ultimately be the success that they had dreamt of.
Yeah, yeah. Yeah, it's a classic story of it's always darkest before the dawn. Yeah, no question about it.
The Wright brothers and Langley knew of each other's efforts. They were independent efforts, but there was some communication between them. Not exactly cooperation, however.
No. Langley was hearing about the Wrights from a mutual friend, Octave Chanute, an engineer in Chicago, who was active in aeronautics, and was more and more curious about what the Wrights were up to when he was hearing these reports of successful glider flights. So he kind of invited himself down to Kitty Hawk at one point, but the brothers sort of shunted him off, said, "Nah, we're really not going to be here that long. It's very difficult to get here. Maybe we'll catch you next time." So they never met.
At one point, you say mysteries evaporated as the Wrights began to try to finally hone the angle of the wings and some of those small details, and then a surprising complication, trying to develop exactly the right propeller. That proves to be kind of a surprising challenge. You mentioned the fact that there was very little science known about that at that point in time.
Yeah, they had thought that nautical propellers would have generated a large body of theory that they'd be able to follow, but in fact there wasn't much of that. Nautical propellers had been made on sort of a trial and error basis, and it had evolved gradually. So they had to sort of figure out their own propeller theory, and they did that again with their wind tunnel, which they had used for figuring out the proper shape of their wings. And they came up with this theory that a propeller is essentially a rotating wing, providing lift in a horizontal direction, if you will.
In that fall of 1903, the Wright brothers are poised for success, but Langley is also undergoing, in sort of desperate fashion, his experiments and then his test flights in his manned aerodrome, flights which in some respects seem to come close but do not achieve the flight which he was after.
Right.
And this is in the specter of all kinds of money having been spent and the money nearly gone. It's sad to read of those desperate final weeks of his effort.
This is a sort of a good argument for amateurism, because Langley was so beholden to the War Department and so dependent on them for funding that he felt that he had to get some kind of a successful public experiment accomplished in order to get more funding and keep working on the problem. The Wrights, who were beholden to no one whatsoever, totally using their own money and without public attention, could, if they had failed on December 17, 1903, no one would have been the wiser, and they would have simply kept working.
Hmm.
The failures that scientists inevitably go through didn't cause a problem for them, whereas with Langley, there were dozens of reporters looking over his shoulder all the time.
On the 15th of December, the Wright brothers knew they were incredibly close, and it's interesting how their father receives a telegram from Wilbur, which says, "Success assured. Keep quiet." Right up to the very edge of their great achievement, they were aware of the importance of keeping quiet.
Yeah, yeah. They did have their family inform the press once they could claim to have successfully flown. But again, they were up against this problem of people not quite understanding what that meant. But everybody knew that people had flown in lighter than aircraft. So why was this so special? And so even their press release of the evening of December 17th, 1903, was almost completely ignored.
We're almost out of time, and I need to mention the fact that, first of all, you take us almost minute by minute through the dramatic events in December of 1903, and, of course, that great success when flight is achieved. But we are maybe two-thirds of the way through the book.
Yeah, even just halfway, I think.
Yeah, something like that. The story from that first flight is of what?
Well, the Wrights had to do two things. They had to perfect this to make it practical. I mean, this was flown on December 17th, 1903. So they had two more years of work before they really had a practical airplane. Then they had to sell it, and in a perhaps more important way, they had to convince the world that they really had been first. And so that fills out another 3 or 4 years. And it's not until the fall of 1909, when Wilbur makes spectacular flights over New York City, that everyone was really convinced that, that this was the future and that the Wrights had paved the way.
You quote Wilbur Wright at one point saying,